So I want you to look around the room you were sitting in right now. Like, really look at it. You see a wall, maybe a window, a chair, a coffee cup resting on a desk.
Yeah, and it all feels entirely obvious, right? Solid, unquestionable.
Right. You look at a chair, and your brain just automatically says, chair. But mathematically speaking, your brain is currently performing this desperate high wire act of subtraction just to stop you from going completely insane.
It really is. Today, we are looking at a radical scientific framework that suggests reality, like the solid, workable world you interact with every single day, is actually just what happens when your universe decides to stop paying attention to almost everything.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
And it's a profound shift in how we understand existence. I mean, we are so accustomed to the idea that the universe is built out of tiny, distinct building blocks.
Quarks, atoms, physical forces, yeah.
Exactly. And that if we just stack enough of them together, eventually, boom, we get a human mind capable of experiencing the world.
We basically treat the mind as the final product at the end of a long cosmic assembly line.
Which, makes sense on a surface level. First you get the Big Bang, then you get stars, then rocks, then water, biological life. And millions of years later, you get the feeling of listening to this deep dive.
But the material we are unpacking today flips that entire assembly line completely upside down.
It really does. We are looking at a, honestly, a pretty dense but incredible February 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz. It's titled Consciousness, Closure, and the Cosmos, version 3.3.
And the mission of our deep dive today is to explore this new consciousness-first scientific framework.
Right, because we aren't just asking how the brain makes thoughts, we're asking a much bigger, much more terrifying question, honestly. Why does our chaotic, wildly complex universe stabilize into a workable, describable world in the first place?
What makes Dietz's 2026 paper so remarkable is its discipline. I mean, this bridges hardcore philosophy, multivariate mathematics, cosmology, and neuroscience.
Yeah, it covers a lot of ground.
It does, but it does so through a methodology called constructive empiricism.
Okay, let's unpack this, because constructive empiricism sounds like a term that could easily put someone to sleep if we don't ground it. Like, what does that actually mean for you, the listener, who just wants to understand their own mind?
That's a fair question. So think back to the philosopher Bas van Frassen, who popularized this concept around 1980. The goal of constructive empiricism isn't to declare some absolute, ultimate metaphysical truth about what the universe is behind the curtain.
So it's not claiming to have all the answers.
No, it doesn't demand that you take a leap of faith. Instead, it asks a more practical question. Can we build a mathematically rigorous model that successfully predicts and saves the phenomena we actually observe?
Interesting.
Dietz takes this philosophy and applies it directly to consciousness. So the paper provides a testable framework without forcing us to pick a side in those endless, exhausting wars over whether the mind is purely physical or a complete illusion or some magical ghostly substance.
It gives us a way to measure the ghost, regardless of what the ghost is actually made of.
Exactly.
And to even begin approaching this, the paper demands that we completely reorient our starting point. Like, if you look at the dominant scientific paradigms of the last few decades, theories from heavyweights like Bernard Barres with his global workspace theory back in 1988, or the work of Stanislaus Dehaene or Daniel Dennett.
Yeah, almost all of them treat consciousness as this late arriving phenomenon.
Right. They treat subjective experience as an output, a
Yeah.
very complicated output of neuronal firing, obviously, but an output nonetheless.
A side effect of physical processes that were already humming along just fine without it. But Dietz argues that this traditional approach fundamentally misunderstands the nature of the problem.
How so?
In this new framework, subjective experience is not the side effect. It is the primary datum. It is the absolute, undeniable ground floor of reality.
Because it is literally the only thing you cannot fake.
Right.
Like, you could be dreaming right now, you'd be in a computer simulation. The chair you were looking at might not physically exist, but the fact that you were experiencing the illusion of a chair.
The fact that a point of view exists at all.
Yes, that is happening. That's undeniable.
Dietz emphasizes that this isn't some clever conclusion we reach at the end of a third-person scientific experiment. The bare, simple feeling of I am is the fundamental condition under which any scientific theory is ever encountered or theorized or tested in the first place.
You cannot step outside of experience to measure experience.
Exactly. You're always already inside it.
So Dietz introduces a very specific lexicon to help us talk about this without falling into the old traps. There is a distinction made right at the beginning of the paper between big C and little c.
Right, the core lexicon.
And I want to get this metaphor right for the listener. So in my head, I'm picturing big C as a blank movie screen and little c as the movie playing on it. Like, the screen is the raw capacity for an image, and the movie is the actual content, the plot, the characters, the colors. Does that map onto Dietz's distinction?
Let's test that analogy. I mean, the movie screen idea is really common, but it actually falls a bit short of what Dietz is proposing here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, specifically because of a concept in the paper called the symmetry thesis. If you think of a movie theater, the screen is made of canvas or vinyl, right? And the movie is made of projected light.
Right, they're two different things.
Exactly. They are two entirely different physical substances interacting. But Dietz's symmetry thesis explicitly argues that big C and little c are not different substances. They are identical. They both refer simply to presence.
Oh, I see the flaw in my theater metaphor then. So how should we visualize it if they're the same stuff?
A much more accurate way to visualize it is to imagine a massive, formless block of uncarved marble. That raw, unstructured marble is big C. It is irreducible presence.
The bare, unadorned fact that experience is occurring.
Yes, completely empty of specific details.
Yeah.
Little c, then, is the highly detailed statue that has been carved out of that exact same block of marble.
Oh, wow. Okay, that makes so much more sense. The statue is made of the exact same material as the raw block.
Right.
The only difference is that boundaries have been drawn. Constraints have been applied.
Precisely. Little c is localized consciousness with content. When you look at the statue, you see the folds of a robe, the expression on a face.
So in your mind, little c is your memory, your perception of the chair in your room, your attention, your emotions.
Your sense of having a narrative identity, yeah. It is presence that has been restricted, stabilized, and organized by your biological and cognitive limits.
And this distinction between the uncarved block and the carved statue is incredibly relevant to you as a listener. Like, think about a moment when you were in a state of sheer panic.
Oh, sure.
Say you're overwhelmed at work, your inbox is an absolute disaster, three people are talking to you at once, and you just spill coffee all over your laptop.
A nightmare scenario.
Right. In that moment, your little seat, your consciousness with content is absolute chaos.
Yeah.
The statue is a mess of jagged edges.
But underneath all of that noise, the foundational fact that you are experiencing anything at all, your big C, the raw marble of presence, remains perfectly intact.
It's pristine and undamaged.
Recognizing that distinction allows the framework to maintain that vital metaphysical neutrality we discussed earlier.
Like the constructive empiricism thing.
Exactly. A neuroscientist who believes the brain creates everything can say that big C is just a theoretical placeholder for whatever underlying neural activity generates awareness.
While a philosopher who believes consciousness is a fundamental property of the universe can say big C is an ontological bedrock.
And the operational science in Dietz's paper works flawlessly for both of them. We just bypass the impossible hard problem of how the marble was created in the first place.
And instead, we can focus entirely on the mechanics of how the statue gets carved.
Which is the exact pivot point of the whole paper.
Right. How does the universe go from a formless block of marble to a highly detailed statue? Like, how do we transition from a chaotic, infinite openness into a world of distinct, recognizable objects that we can actually walk around in and describe?
That transition is achieved through a mechanism Dietz borrows from the philosopher Hilary Lawson, originally published back in 2001. The mechanism is called closure.
Closure. Now, in everyday language, we use that word to mean an ending, like getting closure after a bad breakup.
Right. But here, it is a highly active, continuous, and dynamic operation. In this framework, closure is the operation by which an open, indeterminate background is stabilized into a workable world.
It is the literal act of carving the marble.
Yes. It is the imposition of boundaries, the drawing of distinctions, and the establishment of rules for how things are allowed to change and interact.
To really grasp closure, we need two more terms from Dietz's lexicon. We had big C and little c for consciousness. Now we have big M and little m for the world itself.
Big M represents the global openness beyond any closure grammar whatsoever. It is the infinite, unnameable, unpartitioned background of reality.
It is the raw data of the universe before a single line has been drawn around anything.
Exactly.
It's like the ultimate static, a frequency so dense with information that it's completely impossible to read.
And little m is the localized version of that infinite openness. Little m is the horizon of unspecifiability that you uniquely encounter.
So it's the mystery immediately in front of you.
Yes, determined entirely by your specific physical and cognitive limits. You cannot perceive infrared light, you cannot hear dog whistles, and you cannot process 10 billion data points a second.
So your little M is the localized fog of reality that your brain has to constantly push through.
Exactly. And closure is the weapon we use against that fog. It is the tool that stabilizes little M. But Dietz doesn't just treat closure as a simple binary switch, like it's either on or off.
Right. The paper breaks it down into a triad, three distinct standpoints. And I feel like we really need to take our time here, because if you miss one of these three legs of the stool, the whole theory collapses into reductionism.
It does. Let's start with the first standpoint, which is capacity.
Okay.
Capacity is the phenomenological standpoint. It dictates the absolute practical requirements for you to have a contentful experience at all. If you are going to experience a world, distinctions must be drawn.
Right. Identities must persist long enough for you to track them across time.
Yeah. If you are an early hominid walking through the tall grass, and you cannot perceptually separate the orange and black stripes of a tiger from the shadows of the grass.
You're not going to have experiences for very much longer.
Exactly. You'll be lunch. Your brain must impose a boundary. It must say, this is grass, which is safe background noise, and this is a tiger, which is a highly salient object.
Because without that boundary, you don't experience a world. You just experience a blur.
The imposition of that boundary is the capacity for experience. Now, the second standpoint in the triad is variational stability.
Okay, variational stability.
This takes a dynamical, almost thermodynamic view of the brain. Out of all the near infinite mathematically possible ways you could draw lines in the grass to parse the raw visual data, why does your brain draw the specific lines that it does?
Because it's trying to save energy, right?
Yes. The paper frames it as settling into a minimum within an energy landscape. Closure means finding a metastable basin. Your brain is constantly running this optimization algorithm that trades off two conflicting goals.
Which were?
How accurately a model fits the incoming sensory data versus how complex and energetically expensive that model is to maintain.
So variational stability is the universe, or your nervous system, finding the simplest, most efficient model that keeps you alive.
It's the path of least cognitive resistance that still accurately predicts the tiger.
Okay, so we have capacity, which is the need for boundaries, and variational stability, the energy-efficient math of drawing them. What is the third standpoint?
The third standpoint is consistency. This moves beyond the individual brain and looks at the intersubjective world.
The shared world.
Right. If you and I are walking through the woods together, we don't just need to form our own individual closure states, we need a shared world. Different agents must stabilize distinctions and identity criteria that overlap sufficiently for us to communicate.
Right. We don't have to experience the exact same subjective shade of green when we look at a leaf. Like, I don't know what it feels like to be inside your head.
Right.
But our closure grammars have to overlap enough that if I say, hey, don't eat that green leaf, it's poisonous, you know which object in the open background I'm pointing at.
Exactly. And the discussion of consistency leads to one of the most fascinating pivots in the entire paper. Dietz explicitly connects this shared structural overlap to Carl Jung's 1952 concept of synchronicity.
Wait, Carl Jung? Like mystical synchronicity. This blew my mind when I read it, because Jung is often associated with mysticism.
Very much so.
Synchronicity is usually defined as this spooky, a causal connecting principle. The idea that two events are bound together by deep psychological meaning rather than strict physics.
Like thinking about an old friend you haven't seen in 10 years and then they suddenly call you on the phone.
Right. And people usually write that off as magic or just confirmation bias.
But Dietz rescues synchronicity from the realm of magic and gives it a highly rigorous structural reading.
How does that work?
In the closure framework, meaningful coincidences and shared subjective realities do not require a pre-established mystical harmony, and they don't require physical particles bumping into each other in a chain reaction either.
Oh.
Instead, synchronicity emerges because multiple observers are actively participating in overlapping closure grammars.
Because we are both carving our statues out of the exact same block of marble using very similar tools.
Yes. The meaning isn't floating in the ether somewhere. The meaning is a structural requirement of the shared grammar we are using to survive.
That is so cool. And to ground this triad of closure in your daily life, the listener, imagine you are driving on a rural road at midnight and a massive wall of fog rolls in. You can barely see past the hood of your car.
The visual data hitting your retinas is just a chaotic gray blur. This is a very high little M state.
Right. You are immersed in local unspecifiability. Suddenly, a dark blob appears in the mist ahead. Your heart spikes. Your brain frantically cycles through models. Is it deer? Is it a pedestrian? Is it just a weird shadow?
And then, suddenly, the angles resolve. You realize it is a parked tractor.
That moment of realization, that click in your brain when the blur snaps into a solid object, is at a closure state.
That is the quintessential experience of cognitive and phenomenal closure. Your brain took an ambiguous open input, constrained it, and stabilized a distinction.
It selected the simplest, most stable model that fit the data.
Exactly, allowing you to act, in this case, to slam on the brakes.
But Dietz refuses to stop at psychology. I mean, the paper pushes this framework out of the human skull and applies it to the entire cosmos.
Yes, and this is where the theory shifts from epistemology, which is the philosophy of how we know things, to an actual ontic hypothesis about the physical universe itself.
The ontic hypothesis. This is probably the boldest claim in version 3.3.
It is. Dietz proposes that closure is not just a mental trick performed by biological brains. Closure is the fundamental operation of reality itself.
Wow.
The paper hypothesizes that the Big Bang was not simply a physical explosion of matter tearing through pre-existing empty space and time.
Which is how almost everyone pictures it, like a giant firecracker going off in a dark room.
Under this framework, that Newtonian image is conceptually incoherent. Instead, the Big Bang is framed as a cosmological phase transition.
A phase transition.
It was the moment a stable closure grammar first obtained out of global openness, out of Big M. It was the universe drawing its very first distinctions.
The onset of grammar. The universe establishing the foundational rules of the game. Like what counts as an object, what counts as space, what transformations are mathematically allowed. It's the universe carving itself out of the marble.
This elegantly bypasses the agonizing cosmological paradox of asking, well, what happened before the Big Bang?
Because if the Big Bang is the onset of the closure grammar that defines time and sequence, then asking what happened before it is like asking what is north of the North Pole.
Exactly. The concept of before simply doesn't exist outside the closure grammar.
Okay, my brain is vibrating a little bit, but we need to stay grounded. Because whether we are talking about the Big Bang creating the universe or your brain recognizing a parked tractor in the fog, there is a massive, unavoidable catch to this entire process.
There's always a catch.
Whenever you carve a shape out of raw dough using a cookie cutter, no matter how efficient you are, there is always leftover dough.
Right.
In Dietz's framework, no closure is ever perfect. Every time you draw a boundary, you leave something out. And this brings us to the central engine of the entire theory, which is the concept of remainder.
Remainder is the vital heartbeat of this framework. Dietz formally defines remainder as the residual mismatch that persists when any closure-constrained model family is fit to an empirical structure.
Okay, so when you force the infinite open background of reality into a finite workable description, the parts of reality that do not fit into your description do not simply vanish.
They persist. They push back, and that pushback is the remainder.
It is the leftover mystery. And what's crucial for you to understand is that this isn't a glitch. It's not a bug in your brain's software that evolution will eventually patch.
No, it is operationally unavoidable. Any system with finite resources must exclude possibilities to function. To model a world, you must ignore most of it.
Dietz breaks this remainder down into three specific empirically separable flavors. And looking at these three types really helps clarify what is actually happening when we make an error. So let's start with estimation remainder, or R sub E.
Estimation remainder arises from finite data and measurement noise. It is essentially the error of limited sampling.
Like trying to identify a song when you only hear 2 seconds of it playing through a blown-out, static-filled speaker.
Okay.
You might guess the wrong song because you just don't have enough clear data points.
And ideally, as you get better equipment or collect more data, estimation remainder should shrink. But even with infinite data, you hit the second flavor, approximation remainder or R sub A.
Okay, approximation remainder.
This error arises from the structural limitations of the chosen model family itself.
I love the analogy of trying to build a perfectly round wheel using only straight rectangular logo bricks.
Oh, that's a great way to picture it.
Right. It doesn't matter if you have 10 bricks or 10 billion bricks. Because of the nature of the tool you are using straight lines, your wheel is always going to be slightly jagged. The model itself cannot perfectly map to the reality of a true circle.
An excellent visualization. And that leads directly to the core target of Dietz's framework, closure remainder, or R sub C.
The big one.
This is the deep structural constraint forced by the very act of imposing a distinction in the first place. It is the structured openness that remains once a non-trivial boundary has been drawn.
This is where abstract philosophy crashes right into your daily life. Think about a time when you experienced true novelty.
Like culture shock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe you traveled to a radically different culture, or maybe a person you thought you knew intimately did something completely out of character that shocked you. You feel this deep sense of ambiguity, a strange vertigo, a lingering feeling that the world could have unfolded otherwise.
And we usually treat that feeling as a psychological quirk.
But Deutz is saying that feeling is you directly experiencing remainder at the phenomenal level. You are feeling the leftover dough of the universe brushing up against the edges of your mind.
It is a profound realization. Remainder ensures that no closure ever becomes completely terminal. The mismatch, the error, the mystery, that is what keeps your experience of the world dynamic and moving forward.
But wait, let me challenge this. Because physicists have been chasing a theory of everything for nearly a century?
They have.
What if they succeed? What if we eventually build a mathematical model that is so broad, so perfectly permissive, that it seamlessly covers every single phenomenon in the cosmos? Doesn't the mismatch disappear? Doesn't the remainder drop to absolute zero?
Dietz anticipates this exact objection. The text specifically addresses the zero remainder edge case in the formal definitions. You can absolutely create a model that drops remainder to zero.
Wait, really? So we can conquer the mystery?
We can, but the cost is absolute utility.
What do you mean?
Dietz provides the mathematical example of a one-block model. Imagine you adopt a closure grammar that states, the universe consists of one single, giant, undifferentiated block. Anything that appears to happen inside it is just a fluctuation of that one block.
Okay. That sounds like a philosophical cop-out.
It is, mathematically speaking. Because if you test empirical data against that one-block model, your remainder is zero. The model fits perfectly because the model restricts absolutely nothing. It makes no specific claim, so it can never be wrong.
Oh. But it also doesn't tell me anything. Like, a one-block model doesn't help me distinguish between a glass of water and a glass of poison.
Right.
It doesn't help me build an airplane or cure a disease.
Precisely. A model with zero remainder fails to draw useful distinctions. True, pragmatic closure is not merely about achieving fit. It is about achieving fit under constraint.
Under constraint, right.
As we will see when we look at the math later, it is the complexity penalties in the universe's objective function that favor structured, bounded models over unconstrained, useless ones.
So to make sense of the world, you have to constrain it. And the millisecond you constrain it, you generate remainder.
Yes.
Mystery is fundamentally baked into the physics of knowing anything at all. Which is probably why the universe didn't try to solve the whole puzzle in one single step. To manage this infinite remainder, stabilization happens in distinct layers. Dietz calls this the nested closure ladder.
The ladder is a conceptual map organizing how regimes of stabilization emerge from the Big Bang all the way up to the human mind. Each rung provides the stable platform necessary for the next rung to form.
Let's climb the ladder. The bottom rung is cosmic closure.
We touched on this with the ontic hypothesis. Cosmic closure is the onset of the macro grammar, the establishment of space-time, the basic energetic horizon.
From there, we step up to physical and chemical closures.
Operating within the rules of cosmic closure, physical systems begin to stabilize. Deutz references physicists Elliot Leeb and Robert Seringer's rigorous 2010 mathematical work on the stability of matter.
Okay.
This rung is about the stabilization of molecular identities, the universe figuring out how to make atoms bond into molecules that don't just instantly fly apart.
Once you have stable matter, you have a foundation for the next massive leap, biological and cognitive closures.
This is where self-maintaining systems emerge. Biology stabilizes autopoiesis, the ability of a cell to distinguish its internal chemistry from the external environment and maintain itself.
Cognitive closures take that biological imperative and scale it.
Right, stabilizing perception, memory, and action selection so the organism can navigate a complex niche.
And finally, perched at the very top of the ladder is phenomenal closure. This is you. This is the stabilization of your empirical narrative self.
Yes.
It is the closure state that binds your disjointed memories, your current sensory data, and your future anxieties into a single cohesive perspective that lets you look in the mirror and say, I am the same person today that I was yesterday.
The critical conceptual rule of this ladder is emergence without reduction. Higher level closures absolutely depend on lower level ones, but they cannot be entirely reduced to them.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If you take a sledgehammer to the bottom rungs, the top rungs collapse. Like, if chemistry suddenly stops working in your body, your biology shuts down instantly.
Obviously.
But biology is not just chemistry. A living cell has identity criteria. Yeah. It has a drive to survive and replicate that simply do not exist in the level of blind chemical reactions. You cannot explain natural selection using only the vocabulary of quantum mechanics.
No, you can't.
Each new level of closure introduces entirely new rules and transformations that are native only to that rung.
And understanding that non-reducibility completely shatters our traditional understanding of time. Dietz's treatment of time is arguably the most paradigm-shifting aspect of the paper.
I agree. We intuitively view time from a Newtonian perspective, right? Like a giant invisible container, a cosmic clock ticking away in the background, completely independent of the events happening inside it. We treat time like the empty stage that the actors of the universe walk around on.
But Dietz rejects the empty stage. Temporal notions are treated as internal features of stabilized regimes, not external containers. The paper distinguishes between three specific types of time.
Let's carefully walk through these because this is going to be incredibly important for our final thought later. First is physical time.
Physical time, denoted in physics by the letter T, is the internal coordinate used in our physical theories. It orders physical events and allows us to calculate dynamical laws, like the trajectory of a thrown baseball. It is a feature within the cosmic closure grammar.
Okay, the time of physics. But then Dietz introduces closure time.
Closure time is denoted by the Greek letter tau. Tau does not measure the movement of objects. It indexes the updates of closure states themselves.
Oh, interesting.
Think back to the tractor in the fog. When your brain shifted from the stable model of blurry fog to the updated stable model of parked tractor, that cognitive update is indexed by tau.
Okay, I see.
It is an ordering parameter for stabilization. And crucially, tau does not have to tick at the exact same continuous rate as physical time T.
And the third type is the one we actually care about subjectively. Phenomenological time, the literal, visceral feeling of time passing for you and me.
In this framework, phenomenological time is not a passive experience of T. Phenomenological succession is literally the rhythm of those closure updates, the tau index occurring against a background of trace memory.
Wait, are you saying that the feeling of time passing is just the feeling of my brain constantly encountering mismatch, breaking its model and building a new one? Like, the rhythm of the updates is time.
That captures it perfectly. Your sense of time flowing is the ongoing rhythmic process of your brain making a closure, encountering remainder, updating the closure, and repeating.
Okay, pause, take a breath. This is a beautiful, staggering philosophical architecture. Big C versus little c, the nested ladder, the triad of closure. Time is the rhythm of cognitive updates.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. But at the top of the show, we promised constructive empiricism. We promised that Dietz is a scientist treating this as a rigorous operational research program. If this is science, it cannot just be poetry.
We have to be able to measure it.
Exactly. If my brain is actively calculating closure and remainder to build reality, what is the actual mathematical formula it is using?
To find the formula, we turn to section 7 of the paper, where Dietz introduces a modest mathematical proxy for closure. The goal here is to provide a concrete, computable handle on stabilization, so the entire philosophical theory can be stress tested against raw data.
And Dietz is admirably humble here. This proxy isn't claiming to be the absolute God's eye truth of reality. It's a tool. It models a candidate closure, which we will call K, using two specific mathematical parameters.
Right. A partition of degrees of freedom, denoted by pi, and a sparse interaction graph, denoted by E.
Let's translate that into plain language. A degree of freedom in statistics is simply a variable, a discrete piece of data that can change. A partition pi means taking a massive set of variables and grouping them into distinct blocks or categories.
Yes.
And the interaction graph E is the map that dictates how those distinct blocks are allowed to relate and interact with one another.
So to give an example.
Actually, let me try one. If I'm looking at a stadium filled with 50,000 shouting fans, the individual people are my raw degrees of freedom. It's too much data.
Way too much data to process individually.
So my brain applies a partition pi. I group them by the colors of the jerseys they're wearing, home team versus away team. That's my partition. Then my interaction graph E defines the rules. Home team fans will cheer when their team scores. Away team fans will boo. I have just taken 50,000 chaotic data points and stabilized them into a workable closure model K.
That is exactly how the proxy operates. But how do we know if your model is any good? How do we mathematically measure the remainder, the amount of reality your stadium model is missing?
How do we do that?
Dietz defines remainder mathematically as the minimum Kullback-Leibler divergence.
Tail divergence. Okay, this is a heavy concept from information theory. Let's try to visualize it. Imagine you take a stunning, high-resolution, uncompressed, raw photograph of a forest.
Okay.
Every single leaf, every shadow is perfectly captured. That photo is the universe's open background. Now, you need to email that photo, but the file size is too big, so you compress it into a low-resolution JPEG.
And you lose millions of pixels.
Right. The leaves become blocky green squares. The kale divergence is the mathematical measurement of exactly how much information was lost in that compression. It is the precise measurement of the pixelation.
That is a brilliant analogy. The kale divergence calculates the mismatch between the true, open, empirical data distribution and the simplified, constrained model you're forcing it into. It measures the exact volume of the leftover dough.
Okay, so we can measure the error, but we run into the problem we discussed earlier. We don't just want a model that fits perfectly but is infinitely complex like the useless one-block model. We need a way for the universe or the brain to select the best workable closure.
To achieve that, Dietz introduces the variational closure objective. It is essentially a scoring function. The equation is S equals R plus lambda times the complexity of E plus gamma times the complexity of pi.
I am going to step in and play translator again, because there's profound beauty in this equation once you see the mechanics of it. S is the total score of the closure model you are testing. Like in golf, you want the score to be as low as possible.
Yes, S is the optimization target.
The first term, R, is the remainder we just talked about, the KL divergence, how badly your model fits the raw data. If your model fits reality well, R drops to a low number.
Right.
But you don't get off that easy, because the equation adds two massive penalties. The lambda term multiplies the complexity of your interaction graph E, and the gamma term multiplies the complexity of your partition pi.
The complexity penalties are the gatekeepers of pragmatic reality. If you try to build a model that has 10 million tiny categories with a billion complex interactions between them, your remainder R might drop to near zero, but your complexity penalties will skyrocket. The penalties will ruin your total score S.
So this mathematical equation is literally Occam's razor encoded into algebra. It is mercilessly forcing the system to find the perfect equilibrium between being accurate, which means a low remainder, and being energetically simple, which means low complexity.
This raises an important question, though. We have the philosophy and we have the algebraic equation, but what actually happens if we unleash this Occam's razor equation onto raw, structureless data? Does it actually discover meaningful objects?
Dietz proves that it absolutely does in section 8 of the paper through calibration studies. And looking at the data from these synthetic trials is incredibly satisfying. They run the mathematical proxy on two artificial systems generated inside a computer, System A and System B.
Let's detail System A first. System A is engineered to have a hidden modular structure. Imagine a 6x6 grid representing the correlations between six distinct variables. Dietz secretly plants a structure in the math. Variables 1, 2, and 3 are highly correlated with each other, forming a tight behavioral block.
Yeah.
Variables 4, 5, and 6 are also highly correlated with each other, forming a second block. But the crosstalk between the two blocks, say, between variable 2 and variable 5, is incredibly weak.
So it's clearly two distinct objects hiding in the noise, a group of 3 and another group of 3. So Dietz feeds this raw data into the scoring equation to see if the math can figure out where the natural boundaries are without being given any hints.
The results are unequivocal. When the algorithm tests a 3 plus 3 true partition grouping variables, 1, 2, and 3 together, and 4, 5, and 6 together, the calculated remainder is astonishingly low, 0.006702. The model fits beautifully, and the complexity penalties remain minimal. It achieves a near-perfect score.
But watch what happens if the equation tests a false model. If it tests a 3 plus 3 mixed partition, like grouping variables 1, 3, and 5 into one object and 2, 4, and 6 into another, the calculated remainder just explodes. It shoots up to 1.237241.
A massive jump.
Right. The math overwhelmingly rejects the false partition. It automatically assigns the natural structure of the universe just by trying to lower its score.
System A proves the math works when structure exists. But System B is where the true philosophical power of Dietz's proxy is demonstrated. System B is the uniform system.
In System B, Dietz creates a 6x6 grid where all six variables are equally uniformly correlated with one another. There's no hidden structure, there are no natural objects, it is just a smooth, blurry gradient of data.
This is the ultimate stress test. If the closure framework were fundamentally flawed, if it were overly aggressive, it might arbitrarily force a structure onto this noise just to satisfy the math. It might hallucinate objects where none exist. What do the results show?
The math essentially throws its hands up in the air. When the algorithm tests a 3 plus 3 partition, it gets a remainder of 0.293893. But when it tests a completely different partition of the exact same size, the remainder is identically 0.293893. The scores are totally degenerate, they tie.
The mathematical landscape becomes flat and ambiguous. The equation stubbornly refuses to invent a privileged structure when the underlying data is just a uniform blur.
That's amazing.
This confirms that the objective function behaves with perfect structural integrity. It recovers boundaries when they exist, and it refuses to impose artificial ontology when they do not.
It is incredibly rare and satisfying to see heavy philosophical concepts map so perfectly onto a spreadsheet. But we still have one final hurdle to clear. The math works on artificial data in a computer simulation. That's great for calibration, but the central mission of this deep dive is about consciousness. It's about you, the listener.
Right, the human element.
How do we prove this invisible closure calculation is actually happening inside the wet, squishy neurons of your brain?
That is the ultimate bridge. In the final major phase of the paper, Dietz proposes a methodology to map these exact mathematical invariants, the remainder, the complexity penalties, the stabilization rate directly onto the subjective human experience using brainwaves.
We're looking for the biological fingerprint of the KL divergence.
Precisely. Dietz proposes utilizing an EEG oddball pilot study. Electroencephalography, EEG, measures the electrical activity pulsing across the surface of your brain. Crucially, EEG operates at millisecond resolution.
Which is fast enough to catch cognitive closure updates happening in real time.
Exactly.
Let's put you, the listener, directly into this experiment. Imagine you are sitting in a quiet, sterile laboratory. You have a tight fabric cap pulled over your head, covered in dozens of cold, gel-filled electrodes pressing against your scalp. You are staring at a blank wall, and you are listening to a sequence of tones played through headphones.
Mm-hmm.
Beep, 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 beep. The pitch is identical. The timing is identical.
Within a few seconds, your brain adapts. It forms a highly stable closure state. The model is simple. I am in a room listening to a repetitive, predictable tone.
Because the environment perfectly matches your internal model, your calculated remainder is incredibly low. You are energetically relaxed. But then, boop, without warning, an oddball tone plays. It is a drastically lower pitch, entirely unexpected.
Think about the physical sensation of that moment. You feel a micro jolt of surprise, a tiny spike of adrenaline, your attention snaps into sharp focus. At that exact millisecond, your internal model of reality has spectacularly failed. The sensory data from your ears no longer fits the closure state your brain had stabilized.
And Dietz predicts that if we run the mathematical proxy on the electrical data streaming from your EEG cap at that exact millisecond, we will see a sharp, event-locked spike in remainder.
A transient, massive increase in mismatch. The mathematics of the KL divergence will physically spike in the data. And immediately following that spike, the EEG will show a measurable stabilization curve as your brain frantically updates its closure grammar to integrate the surprise.
Effectively pulling the remainder back down to a workable level. The brain scrambling to build a new model that says, okay, the pattern is mostly beeps, but occasionally there is a boop.
Exactly.
This is brilliant because it's so fiercely specific. Dietz isn't just looking for generic brain activity lighting up on a scan. The proposal is to compute the exact mathematical remainder of the neural networks in real time. And to make it scientifically unassailable, Dietz introduces strict controls.
Indeed. The paper details the use of resting state baselines drawn from default mode network studies, specifically citing Marcus Rachel's foundational 2001 work. When you are just resting, letting your mind wander without a specific task, your brain operates under a baseline closure dynamic.
So they use that as a control.
Comparing the highly structured task-based oddball data against these resting baselines provides the necessary contrast to prove the math is tracking reality.
And what I deeply respect about this paper, what makes it truly rigorous science, is that Dietz explicitly lists the failure modes. Dietz outlines exactly what data would prove the theory wrong.
Which is crucial.
If they run this EEG test and the calculated remainder just tracks basic signal-to-noise ratios, like if the remainder spikes simply because the beep got a few decibels louder or worse, if the remainder flatlines and doesn't spike during the oddball surprise at all, Dietz says the proxy is busted. The theory fails.
It is a refreshing display of empirical vulnerability. It's also crucial to contextualize how this framework interacts with the heavy hitters of modern neuroscience. Dietz extensively references Carl Friesting's predictive processing, the currently dominant theory that the brain is fundamentally a prediction engine trying to minimize surprise.
Or the global workspace theory we mentioned earlier, which views consciousness as a central broadcasting system integrating data from different parts of the brain.
Dietz is not attempting to destroy or replace those mechanistic theories. The closure framework is agnostic to the specific biological mechanism. Whether your brain uses predictive coding, a global workspace, or quantum microtubules, it doesn't matter.
It's supplying a formal structural vocabulary.
The math of closure and remainder. It's a vocabulary for measuring the stabilization breakdown within any of those processes. It gives us a universal metric for ambiguity and mystery.
So what does this all mean for you, navigating your actual life? It means we can entirely recontextualize our daily friction with the world. That feeling of exhaustion when you are learning a complex new skill, that moment of total confusion when a routine is broken, that literal spike in your mental effort that is your brain's remainder spiking.
Yes.
Your internal model of reality has failed, and for a split second, you are exposed to a higher level of the raw, unstructured openness of the universe. You are touching the uncarved marble right before your brain frantically builds a new closure state to protect you and let you function.
It frames confusion not as a failure of intelligence, but as a necessary encounter with the fundamental openness of reality. It is the engine of learning.
We have covered an incredible amount of intellectual ground today. Let's recap the journey of this deep dive. We started with the sheer irreducible datum of existence, Big C. The uncarved marble, the simple pristine presence of being that remains perfectly intact no matter how chaotic your thoughts become.
We explored how our minds, and according to the ontic hypothesis, the cosmos itself via the Big Bang, carved that infinite openness into workable chunks through the active operation of closure.
We examined the triad of capacity, variational stability, and the intersubjective consistency that finally explains Jung's synchronicity structurally rather than magically.
We walk through the mathematical proxy, discovering how the universe uses the penalties of Occam's razor to balance accuracy with simplicity. We proved with the synthetic data in systems A and B that this math can actively discover reality and refuses to invent structure where there is none.
We saw how remainder, the leftover dough, the possibilities excluded by our models, is structurally unavoidable. And we looked at the proposed EEG oddball pilot, a rigorous path to literally map this mathematical remainder onto the electrical rhythms of the human brain.
If we connect this all back to the bigger picture, the true beauty of Dietz's 2026 framework is its profound humility. Constructive empiricism doesn't arrogantly claim to know what reality ultimately is.
It doesn't claim to have solved the metaphysical hard problem of how the marble of consciousness was created out of nothing.
It simply gives us a disciplined, beautiful mathematical way to understand why reality is stable enough for us to investigate it, share it, and experience it together. It provides a structural guarantee that openness and mystery must persist, even in our most advanced, successful, predictive scientific models. We can never build a model that completely captures the infinite.
Humility and mystery, built right into the algebra of the cosmos. But before we let you go, I want to leave you with one final mind-bending implication directly drawn from Section 6 of the paper regarding time. We talked about how phenomenological time, your subjective feeling of time moving forward, is simply the rhythm of your brain updating its closure states, the tau index.
And we established that those closure updates are driven entirely by remainder. Your brain updates its model because the model is slightly wrong, because there is a mismatch with the raw data, because there is leftover mystery it has to process.
Your remainder is what prevents your current closure state from becoming permanent.
But imagine, just for a moment, a hypothetical edge case. Imagine if humanity somehow succeeded in building the perfect theory of everything. Imagine if your personal closure grammar became absolute. Your access to the universe was unlimited, and you built a cognitive model of reality that perfectly, flawlessly matched the infinite open background.
In that state of supreme omniscient understanding, your calculated remainder would drop to absolute zero, and it would remain stably at zero under any perturbation.
According to this framework, if your remainder stably hit zero, your mind would have absolutely no reason to update its closure state.
The tau index would stop ticking. Your phenomenological succession would collapse into a fixed, frozen regime.
Even if the physical universe, physical time chat kept moving around you, with planets orbiting and stars burning, your subjective experience of time would violently halt. you would be frozen in a single, infinite cognitive moment.
In other words, if you ever achieved perfect, zero-mystery understanding of the world, you would stop experiencing the flow of time itself. The mystery, the remainder, the errors you make every single day, they are not flaws in your existence. They are literally what keep your timeline moving forward. They are the friction that keeps you alive to the next moment.
It is a staggering philosophical truth extracted from mathematical optimization. Perfection is stagnation. Mystery is the essential engine of conscious experience.
Thank you for joining us on this incredibly profound deep dive. The next time you look around the room, take a long moment to look at the distinct objects in the chair, the window, the parked car outside, and the fog. Appreciate the incredible, dynamic, ongoing act of closure happening in your mind every single second, carving a workable, beautiful world out of the infinite chaos of the cosmos. Keep learning, keep questioning, and whatever you do, embrace the remainder.